Gracious God, we give you thanks for this glorious day, for the gift that you bring to us each day, the gift we see in each other, the gift we find in your word proclaimed. Bless us this day. Open our ears so that we may hear. In Jesus we pray. Amen. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name's James Miller. I'm in the music department here at Gustavus. I'm one of the band directors. And I was at breakfast this morning with my daughters, and my wife came down the hallway, who's also on the faculty here, and she said to me, "I saw on Facebook that you're going to preach about 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Isn't that when Peter gets a thorn in his side?" I said, "It is." And I was going to engage her in this theological debate. And she said, "You better not be talking about me today." My thinking with this, and I felt really called to talk about this with you this morning, and I've titled it A Week, W-E-E-K, for Week, W-E-A-K. So during my tenure as a professor at Cornell University, I conducted a band and a choir there. I was approached by a student named Mary before rehearsal, and she said, "JPM, everybody calls me that, I am very frustrated with your rehearsals," which is an excellent way to begin a conversation with a professor. She continued, "Almost every day you take the blame for something that isn't your fault. You know it's our fault. I can tell that you know it, but you take the blame anyway. It's like lying. You let us get away with way too much. You need to be meaner when we talk and when we make mistakes and when we screw around in band. You always say stuff like, 'I'm going to try better for you next time,' or 'That must have been my mistake, I'm sorry,' or 'Let's do that again for my sake.'" And then she said, "I'm watching you." She was a spark plug. Then she said the words that have resonated with me really as a person and as a teacher every day since. She said, "You need to blame us when we make mistakes. When it's not your fault, it's not your fault. You need to be stronger and tell us when we're wrong, and that's the only way we're going to actually improve instead of staying the same." That was the end of our conversation, which I would label as one-sided, although I was in attendance. I didn't say anything. I listened, and I felt terrible. Listening and feeling terrible are two things I do very well, so you should stop in any time, and I'd be happy to do that. After our chat that day, I had a couple minutes to chew on what she told me before rehearsal. And you got to understand that at this time in my career, it's my first professorial position, I was 23. And I was barely older than Mary, myself having graduated from St. Olaf Junior College just 2 years earlier. I looked a lot younger then. It was 2003. That year, I actually got carded at Chuck E. Cheese. So that tells you that, you know, establishing myself as an adult, which is still tricky for me, was certainly more challenging than establishing myself as a professor, especially at an Ivy League college. So while I walked into class that day, I was questioning myself and my motivations, and maybe you've had days like that too. I was questioning everything I had been taught in school and at church and at home, to accept blame but never give it, to be vulnerable with emotions and vulnerable with my weaknesses, and to listen before acting. But I thought, you know, maybe I need to be tougher, like harden my heart a little bit and teach those students a thing or two, and so I tried. For one seemingly unending, brutal, painful, awkward with three W's, 90-minute rehearsal, I placed the blame where it belonged. The students, all except for Mary, were staring at me in total bewilderment the entire time. Their glaring, confounded eyes said, "Who are you and what are you doing?" Meanwhile, Mary the entire time went like this. Now, Mary was a great student. She was in the Cornell Veterinary School, and I used to ask her before band every day if she had any little lambs, but she did not like that joke. I practiced that one. Today, ironically, today she's a large animal veterinarian, so she probably tends to many lambs. And she and I are still in touch on what the kids these days call the Facebook. After band on that day, Mary came up to me and she said, "Okay, wow, that did not suit you at all. Forget that I said anything, and wow, you suck at being mean." So I learned about myself and about my teaching and about listening. And I learned about weakness and vulnerability. And I'll never forget that the next rehearsal, I apologized to the group for my actions. And I explained that if there was anything I was proud of most, that it was my extensive list of weaknesses. And from that day forward, I vowed to be vulnerable and to assume it, whatever it was at least in some way my own fault. So here's my first of three challenges for us. If we're going to make this a week, W-E-E-K, to be week, W-E-A-K, then I challenge you to find someone, especially if it's someone that you know that has spoken against you, or better yet, someone that you have spoken against, and boast about their strengths, like totally gush right to their face. And then, and I think this is the most important part, boast about your weaknesses. Apologize. Ask for their advice and see what happens. So this is 2 Corinthians chapter 12. This is verses 10, 7 through 10. Paul is referring to a vision where this man is lifted up into heaven, if you know the story, and he sees the wonders, and he hears things that he can't disclose. They're so wondrous. And then Paul's given a thorn in his side. That's what I think that phrase probably comes from, the thorn in the side. "Therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, quote, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness.' Therefore," Paul says, "I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest upon me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions and difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." A few short months ago, my father-in-law was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. He and I played 18 holes of golf together in late September. Today, May 8th, he can't move his arms and his legs. But it's in this horrible, unfair weakness where amazing strength resides. He is my hero. He is more fit for heaven and to embrace the Lord than so many, including myself, not because of his actions or his deeds, but because of his faith and his unyielding will to live. His weakness is strength. He doesn't complain, even though the most basic elements of everyday life, like brushing his teeth, are impossible for him now. I complain all of the time. I'm not going to ask you to do it, but what if I asked you to raise your hand if you've complained about something in the last 24 hours? I hear complaints every day about being busy and tired and stressed and broke, overworked. My father-in-law's weakness has taught so many, including me, the meaning of how precious and how fragile life is, and how petty and how insignificant our squabbles and problems are. So if you hold a grudge, let it go. Here's my second challenge. For the next 24 hours, none of us are allowed to complain. Not one time. Not about anything or anyone. Zero. None. And if you do, your time starts over. I started earlier and failed 3 times already today. So it's actually really hard. Now, that's not to say that our problems and struggles aren't real, because they are. And they matter. But in the perspective of God's love, they are nothing. Now, what about those people and those struggles that are simply too difficult to face? The relationships that are, for whatever reason, in our eyes, totally beyond repair. Do you ever have those? I do. Well, first, I think God has the power to heal those broken relationships. But second, I think there are people that simply can't reconcile or forgive or apologize, at least not like most people. Martha Stout, in her, it's an incredible book, and I would encourage you to read it. If you've ever had a problem dealing with somebody, you have got to read the book, The Sociopath Next Door. It is extraordinary. She reveals that more than 4% of our population are, in fact, sociopaths. People that cannot feel remorse, have no real conscience the way we understand a conscience, and they can't feel guilt. They don't understand what guilt is. They never think they're wrong. To me, that's a bit frightening, considering that anything else that impacts 4% of our entire society would be considered a pandemic. So it's a little startling. But I think about that statistic as an opportunity for learning. If you face a struggle with another person and you fear that it can't be resolved and it haunts you and you lose sleep over it, then you got to do everything you can do to reach out and to try and be ready for the time when they want or they try to reconcile. But to quote my dad, who's a very smart man, he always says, don't wait around for an apology that isn't coming. Instead, look inside and discover what you can learn about yourself from that conflict and make every effort you can and remain open for the possibility of reconciliation. Philip Yancey, in his book, maybe you've read this, The Bible That Jesus Read, Why the Old Testament Matters. Here's a quote. I have made it a weekly practice on a long walk on the hill behind my home to present to God my great anger against people who have wronged me. I recount all of my reasons for feeling unfairly treated or misunderstood, forcing myself to open up deep feelings to God. Doesn't God really know what those are anyway? I can test that the outpouring itself has a therapeutic effect. Usually I come away feeling as if I have just released a huge burden. The unfairness no longer sticks like a thorn inside of me, as it once did. I've expressed it aloud to someone, to God. Sometimes I find that in the process of expression, I grow in compassion. I love that line. God's Spirit speaks to me of my own selfishness, my judgmental spirit, my own flaws that others have treated with grace and forgiveness, my pitiful, limited viewpoint. So my third challenge, take that walk this week. Open up to God out loud and express your anger for others and see what happens. In this week for week, I'm going to leave you with the words of my literary hero, Rainer Maria Rilke. This is in his letters to a young poet. If you don't know that, or you haven't read Rilke, I would consider an opportunity for you to change your life and get a copy. Rilke writes the following. Believe in a love that is being stored up for you like an inheritance, and have faith that in this love there is a strength and a blessing so large that you can travel as far as you wish without having to step outside of it. You never have to walk outside of that love. And inside of that love, you can journey for unlimited distances. You can conquer any obstacle, no matter how great your weakness, no matter how much pain you feel, no matter how much sorrow is inside of you. Christ's love is so enormous, so all-encompassing, that you are indestructible. You can shed that wheelchair the stress, the problems, and the strains of everyday life, because in the perspective of the love of Christ, it's but a speck of dust. So what brings us nearer to God? Not our talents, not our strengths, and not our boastful nature, which I have, and I'm sure everyone here does too. But it's our weakness. So be weak with me this week. Embrace that if we wish to become nearer to God in every way. We must, as Paul writes, delight in weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and difficulties. Lord, forgive me for my boastful ways, and help me to be nearer to you in all of my weakness.